This is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated April 11th, 2014. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This week's front cover of the newly formatted Triangle Business Journal, The Hops Hype. Triangle residents are crazy about their craft beers, but will the boom last? Brewery survival depends on distribution strategies, funding sources, and the magic formulas that lead to loyal customers. The Beer Buzz by Dawn Curry. The Triangle's craft beer craze is in high gear, but will it last? The Triangle is the South's tech hub, and where geeks live, there is craft beer. The region benefits from low unemployment and a highly educated population that demands salaries above the national average, with a healthy concentration of engineers and skilled workers. These are the same properties that catalyzed Portland's craft beer industry at 126 breweries. It has the largest concentration of craft breweries in the nation. By summer, the Triangle will have at least 32 breweries, plus 9 more across eastern North Carolina. In all, North Carolina has 100 craft breweries, more than any other southern state, some of which distribute across state lines. The swelling beer boom could turn the area into another Portland, and in the process, sink Asheville's reputation as the state's beer city. But industry experts are conflicted. Will the growth sustain itself, or will demand dry up, leaving only the hardiest breweries to survive? Bart Watson, staff economist for Colorado-based Brewers Association, defines a bubble as a period of overinvestment where asset prices aren't aligned with reality. Watson says there is little to fear in the Triangle because growth of the craft beer industry follows the national growth rate, that of steady increase. I see very little signs that this is a bubble in the Triangle, Watson says. There is an increased support for local product, support for small local independent businesses. I don't see that going away. But does variety and innovation mean the public will like the products? Quality is always a concern, but craft beer lovers are more educated than they've ever been, Watson says. Most breweries end up being successful. We've been tracking microbreweries since the 80s, and 70% that have ever opened are still open. With brew pubs, it's 50%. That's incredible when you compare it to restaurants at a 60% failure rate. But North Carolina State University's Robert Hammond, an economics professor who follows the industry, says beer pubs have the life expectancy of a specialty restaurant. If you're trying to exist primarily as a brew pub, look at the average life of a high-end restaurant like a place that serves organic food, he says. It's a high turnover industry. I would expect that breweries trying to exist as such an entity only should have a similar life. Hammond says the local market for craft beer has been sufficiently saturated because most people are already aware of craft beers. He says the only people who aren't drinking craft beers are those who either can't afford it or simply don't like it. Meanwhile, branching into distribution of bottled and canned beer could spell death for a craft brewer. You're not going to make money if the intention is to compete with Bud Light, Hammond says. That slice of the craft beer market exists with the bigger breweries like New Belgium. If you think I'm going to grow the market or steal business from Foothills Brewery in Winston-Salem, you're not going to make it. We should expect that growth to slow. Whether headed for a bubble or not, the craft beer industry has brought measurable value to North Carolina. In 2012, the beer industry contributed $2.9 billion to the state's economy, along with 37,260 jobs, which received $949 million in wages, according to the Beer Institute, a national trade association based in Washington, D.C. Of that, craft beer contributed $791 million with 10,000 jobs, generating $300 million in wages. In 2012, North Carolina had 82 active brewer permits, compared to 63 in 2011. According to a study conducted by the Beer Institute in partnership with the National Beer Wholesalers Association, North Carolina has 94 distributors and 18,331 retailers dedicated to beer. In 2012, these generated $109 million in federal excise taxes, $117 million in state excise taxes, and $124 million in other taxes. In the Triangle, the craft beer industry contributed 4,697 jobs, paying $160 million in wages. Of those jobs, 286 were business and personal service jobs, 157 were finance, insurance, and real estate jobs, and 109 were transportation and communications-related jobs. 85 were agricultural, and 54 were wholesale jobs. Craft beer has an $11.7 share of every $100 spent in North Carolina grocery stores, and a $13.7 share in the Triangle. Craft beer has an 8% volume share in the beer market in North Carolina, according to Chicago-based market research group Information Resources Incorporated. And in 2012, North Carolina produced 159,033 barrels of craft beer, or 4.9 million gallons. As the recession was winding down, shopping for locally sourced ingredients and products became a popular means of supporting local businesses and creating jobs. This movement also added steam to the craft brewery industry. Many Triangle breweries purchased ingredients from Farm Boy Farms in Pittsburgh, run by former architect Michael Hager and his son-in-law Dan Gridley. Aviator Brewing Company of Fuquay Varina has a pale ale coming out soon that will contain American Malting Barley Association recommended two-row malt, a product from Hager's farm. But despite demand, statewide barley production is down, according to the American Malting Barley Association. As it turns out, North Carolina's climate isn't ideal for malting barley, as hot and humid environments often cause the grain to become diseased. That's why the U.S. Department of Agriculture plant science researcher David Marshall, who is based in Raleigh, has spent the past several years developing North Carolina hardy malting barley varieties. Marshall, who has bred small grains for 35 years, developed a trick that helped him grow crops faster and thus accelerated his research. For several years, going back to 2002, we've been sending crops to New Zealand, because you could have a counter season there. So we can harvest here in the late spring and send seeds to New Zealand and get a crop right away, he says. Marshall predicts he will have malting barley perfect for North Carolina's climate on the market by 2016. The Triangle's largest craft brewer, Summit Vora, of Lone Rider Brewing Company in Raleigh, has recently begun distributing his beer in surrounding states. The only thing that needs to be looked at is where you want to be in 3 or 4 years, says Vora. See how much growth you can have in the local market and what makes sense based on your proximity. If you're a brew pub, you have a solid idea in your head where you want to be, because it's like a single unit, a well-functioning restaurant whose primary product is beer. I recommend having a couple of rotating taps from other breweries. Vora says he knows from his launch in 2009 that he wanted to go the distribution route, so he spread his beer across the state, and that came with its own set of challenges. For the first 4 years of business, we only sold in North Carolina, but the growth slows down. That's when we moved out of the state. If you can self-distribute, you should. We chose a distributor because it made the most sense for us. Vora says the distributors take less than 50% of the revenue, and while they care about you, they care about their alliances with Anheuser-Busch more. Cash flow is another element. Vora says brew pubs ought to have cash flow from day one, much like Fortnite Brewing Company in Cary did. Anyone distributing needs at least 12 months of operating capital on hand. It took at least 2 years to get even to that point. Then there were ebbs and flows. It's good to have strong investors if you want quick growth. For the slow, steady growth, you don't need investors from the beginning. We didn't go to investors until our fourth year. Until then, he relied on bank loans and loans from friends. Tech and brewery investor David Gardner was one of those investors. Gardner also invested $250,000 in Fortnite Brewing Company in Cary. A distribution model has almost unlimited revenue potential if the beer and marketing are done well, says Gardner. I have not sold any of my Lone Rider stock, but the company has continued to grow consistently since I made that investment 4 years ago. He and Cree CEO Chuck Swoboda each made investments in Lone Rider, while local tech investor F. Scott Moody invested $50,000 in Fortnite Brewing Company on impulse during a meeting at Gardner's house one night. Fortnite received more than $1 million in funding before its doors opened earlier this year. When it comes to funding, nano brewers tend to put no more than $250,000 toward their business, while microbrewers hover around $500,000. Craft brewers that intend to produce more than 15,000 barrels per year can spend $1 million or more on their business. The money tends to come from savings for smaller projects and bank loans or investors for larger projects. Most people want to start craft brewing as a hobby and don't necessarily want it to be big, says Gardner. They just want enough money to do what they like. But for investors, we want to see a return. We're going to look at it as a manufacturing investment. Most of my investments are software, and I encourage these guys to come up with a plan that's cheap, quick, and tell them to get some sales. I want to see very little money on the front end, but for anything that requires a manufacturing facility like craft beer, the more automated you are on the front end, the more cost effectively you'll be able to scale. Otherwise, you have to throw everything away and basically start over when you want to grow. Here's a beer glossary. Craft beer. Beer made with traditional ingredients such as malted barley and hops, but also includes non-traditional ingredients for added distinctiveness such as banana, cloves, or mango. Microbrewery. Less than 15,000 barrels produced per year. At least 75% of beer is sold off-site. Nanobrewery. Less than 2,000 barrels produced per year and or no more than 3 barrels per batch. A brew pub is a restaurant brewery that sells at least 25% of its beer on site. And a beer barrel has 31 gallons of beer. The top 5 breweries in the Triangle and their flagship beers are number 1 at Lone Rider Brewing Company, Shotgun Betty. Its ingredients are banana and cloves, and the 2013 production was 13,500 barrels. Number 2 is Big Boss Brewing Company. Their beer is Bad Penny, and their ingredients include caramel and chocolate. And the 2013 production was 8,100 barrels. Aviator Brewing Company. Their beer is Devil's Tramping Ground. Ingredients include Belgian candied sugar. The 2012 production was 8,000 barrels. Carolina Brewery. Their key beer is Sky Blue's Kolsch. They have no special ingredients, and their 2013 production was 5,723 barrels. And Carolina Brewery Company. Their lead beer is Carolina Pale Ale, and their ingredients include Willamette and Golding's Hops. 2013 production was 3,500 barrels. This week's column for housing is by Amanda Hoyle, and she has a residential report this week entitled Active Adult Projects in the Works. A new player has entered the Triangle's market active adult home building community with plans to begin development of the long-awaited Bethpage community in Durham this summer. AV Homes Incorporated in February paid $5.1 million for 325 acres at the intersection of Page Road and Chin Page Road near Briar Creek, according to Durham County Deed Records. The Scottsdale, Arizona-based company announced on April 3rd that it had closed escrow on the project. AV Homes is planning to build 650 units on the property for an active adult community we'll call Creekside at Bethpage. Pre-sales are expected to begin in early 2015. It will be AV Homes' first community in the Triangle after opening its Carolinas division office in Huntersville earlier this year and starting construction in 2 traditional communities in Huntersville and in Belmont. But AV Homes is best known for its active adult communities designed for homebuyers who are 55 years or older, such as Solavita and Poinsettia in Central Florida and Cantamia in Goodyear, Arizona, which was named one of the 50 best communities in the U.S. by Where to Retire magazine. At Creekside at Bethpage, AV Homes also plans to build a 15,000-square-foot clubhouse that will have social rooms, a community garden, swimming pool, bocce courts, pickleball courts, tennis courts, billiards, and an aerobic studio. All of the new homes planned at Creekside at Bethpage will be single-level with two-car garages and will range between 1,200 and 2,400 square feet, according to the company. This week's deal of the week is Lake Boone Trail Retail and Office Center was sold to a Chicago group for $15.5 million. The marketplace at Lake Boone Trail Complex in West Raleigh, which is home to offices for Gateway Bank, Ashton Woods Homes, and the Buffalo Brothers Restaurant, has been sold to the Chicago investor group Singerman Real Estate LLC for $15.5 million. The sale happened 4 years after New York investor group Brookfield Property Group bought the property out of foreclosure for $9 million, and it includes 76,000 square feet of office and retail space that was 90% leased at the time of the sale. And in Cary, the Toast Cafe is coming to Cary's Waverly Place. Toast Cafe, a gourmet breakfast concept that's been expanding in the Charlotte region, will be jumping to the Triangle with one of its first restaurant franchise locations opening this summer. Franchise owners Dean Kessel, a former director of marketing for NASCAR's Sprint Cup, and his wife Beth have relocated to Cary from Charlotte with plans to open their own Toast Cafe at the Waverly Place Shopping Center. Kessel says Toast Cafe will be open for breakfast, lunch, and brunch 7 days a week and will have a capacity to seat about 150 people. This week in Jason DeBruin's column that covers healthcare, biotechnology, and pharmaceuticals leads off with a CEO shuffle. Moak resigns following Chimerix's PR blow-up. In the hours following the sudden resignation of Ken Moak, former CEO of Chimerix, company officials offered few details, saying only that they wanted to focus on development of their leading drug, Brincidofovir. The resignation came a month after the company was the target of widespread public ire because it initially declined to provide an unapproved drug to a young cancer survivor. Chief Medical Officer Dr. M. Michelle Berry took over as CEO immediately. The company did not publicly link the resignation to the public outcry. Durham-based Chimerix is developing the drug Brincidofovir to treat viral infections, but it has not yet applied for approval from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. However, the family of first grader Josh Hardy asked that Chimerix give him the drug anyway, as it could possibly help treat an infection he contracted after cancer treatments. Moak and Chimerix initially declined the request, saying it has closed its compassionate use program. The Hardy family took to social media channels, and the national media outlets picked up the story, putting so much pressure on Chimerix that Moak received death threats. Chimerix relented and put together an unplanned clinical trial to test the drug on the type of virus Josh Hardy has. Chimerix also has a Phase 3 trial ongoing to further test Brincidofovir for a particular kind of virus that ails transplant patients. Expenses related to Brincidofovir have totaled $122 million. This week's big numbers in the pharma industry, $3 million. Chapel Hill drug developer Sempra Pharmaceuticals has extended its credit limit with Hercules Technology Growth Capital, Incorporated, by $3 million and will extend the period it makes interest-only payments by 1 year to May 31, 2015. And $20 million. In late 2011, Sempra entered into a $20 million loan and security agreement with Hercules. And this week's deal of the week was Chatham Therapeutics, a Chapel Hill-based private drug developer working on treatments for hemophilia, was acquired for $70 million by Baxter International. The company is announced on April 2nd. And the person who said it this week in the pharma industry is Mr. Todd Pope. He's a TransEnterix president and CEO. TransEnterix announced it would complete a 5-for-1 reverse stock split and no longer list its shares on the over-the-counter bulletin board. Instead, it will list its stock on the NYSE market, New York Stock Exchange, part of the New York Stock Exchange, of course. And he is quoted as saying, "The goal of seeking to list on the national exchange is the potential for increased visibility and liquidity, as well as access to a larger group of investors," end quote. Lauren Onisarge covers technology and entrepreneurship. Her column this week, Moody's Next Move, Smart Technology. 2 years after selling his company and technology to Apple, AuthenTech founder F. Scott Moody is at it again, and this time in the triangle. Moody, who helped develop the fingerprint security technology that Apple uses in its latest iPhone, has taken a slight pivot with his new Raleigh startup, K4 Connect. Basically, K4 Connect is the name of the company that's providing a software platform that connects various things, he says. Those might include security systems, thermostats, lights, any smart technology in the home. He points to a concept that John Chambers, CEO of Cisco, mentions regularly. The Internet of Things, a vision of a connected world where every device you have, from your toothbrush to your refrigerator, is smart connected. What Moody's not doing is explaining exactly how the technology works. The product name is K4 Home. Everybody is coming out with all of these individual devices, whether it's a thermostat, a security system, a door lock, he says. There's just so many different ideas coming out, whether it's big companies or small companies. To figure out what the technology can do, he develops elaborate what-if scenarios, from a security system that turns the lights on when the garage door goes up, to cartoons coming on the TV for your kids as you walk in the door. Moody, who says he got familiar with home automation at AuthenTech because people talked about the fingerprint systems being used for those types of things, says his business acumen is about making the exceptionally complicated into something so simple that the commercial is easy. "When Apple bought out AuthenTech, we had well over 200 patents," he says. "It's complicated stuff. The trick is to take that and make it very simple and very consumerish, and to focus on that consumer, the end user." While the only piece of hardware the six-person company will provide is the K4 Hub, a device that is plugged into your network box, he has had discussions with outside hardware developers. He's not yet ready to announce any partnerships, but does say the technology can be applied to hundreds of devices currently on the market. And this week's By the Numbers column is about Red Hat. $1.53 billion is Red Hat's revenue in fiscal 2014. $178 million is Red Hat's full-year net income in fiscal 2014. Red Hat's top deals in fourth quarter is $1 million. The top 30 deals were all more than $1 million. $5 million out of those 30 deals, 7 of them were more than $5 million. And out of those 30 deals, 2 were valued at more than $10 million. Also at Red Hat, Delisa Alexander is quoted as saying, "More than half of our associates are located outside of the U.S., so you can assume that about half of these roles we're hiring for will be out of the United States." Red Hat plans to hire 800 jobs this fiscal year. Lauren Onisarge, the tech reporter for the Triangle Business Journal, is busy. There's one more article on her column this week. AT&T arms itself to become a player in the fiber wars. On April 10th, AT&T announced it is in advanced discussions with Regional Initiative North Carolina Next Generation Network to deliver its AT&T U-verse with gigapower in parts of the Triangle and Piedmont, including Carrboro, Cary, Chapel Hill, Durham, Raleigh, and Winston-Salem. The next step for the governing bodies of these six communities is to ratify the agreement. Fiber network can deliver speeds of up to 1 gigabit per second. That's 10 times faster than the fastest consumer broadband available here. The plan includes options for public Wi-Fi hotspots, free AT&T U-verse with gigapower at up to 100 public sites, and an all-fiber network connected to up to 100 businesses. This week's column by Dawn Curry also includes small business, and the Raleigh Food Truck Rodeo of 2014 was funded just in time. The Raleigh Food Truck Rodeo 2014 will kick off May 4th after the City Council approved the event's move from May 11th, Mother's Day, a date that had other downtown restaurants upset. Within a week left to fund the rodeo's Kickstarter campaign for $8,000 and only raised $3,000, O2 Fitness came through and dumped the remainder of the needed funds into the campaign. Now the campaign is fully funded at $8,048 with 48 backers. Instead of going with a corporate sponsor, we wanted to give the crowd the opportunity to be the primary sponsor for the event, says rodeo organizer Guy Caprielli. So why did one of the Triangle's biggest gems write a $4,100 check for the food truck rodeo that could see 20,000 visitors from across the nation? We always do what we can do to support our local communities, including events like the Raleigh Food Truck Rodeo, a fantastic event that gives people from around the Triangle and beyond a chance to enjoy our beautiful downtown. That's what Michael D. Olander Jr., CEO of O2 Fitness Clubs, said. Caprielli says the funds needs to go toward a variety of insurances, liabilities, and music equipment. Food trucks from Asheville to Wilmington, and even from as far as Washington State, will join this year's rodeo. Dawn Curry's column also includes an air traffic update, which reports a big drop in RDU traffic in February. Understandable given the weather, less than 400,000 passengers used RDU in February. And this was a drop of 28,000 passengers, or 6% less than last year. January traffic dropped 1.6% when compared with January 2013, and Southwest Airlines enplanement was down 11.5%. Delta Airlines enplanement was also down 1.3%, and U.S. Airways enplanement was down by 8.2%. You should know that women-owned firms are growing dramatically in North Carolina. There are 267,800 firms in North Carolina owned by women. And in those firms, there are 268,300 people employed. And the amount of sales from those firms totals $35.9 million. And now it's time for a better world. People and places responding to philanthropy. Reported by Todd Cohen. Scholarships that change lives. A month before Cuban-born Diane Evia Lanivi was set to begin her senior year at Flagler College in St. Augustine, Florida, the federal Pell Grant she counted on for her tuition was halved as a result of cuts by Congress. So she told the director of admissions, who had employed her in a work-study job since her sophomore year, that she would need to take at least a semester off to earn enough money to return to school. But he persuaded the college president to make up the difference so she could stay in school. Soon after they graduated, she and her future husband, Swedish-born Ingmar Lanivi, also studying at Flagler on a scholarship, vowed that if they ever had the chance, they would create a fund to provide scholarships for low-income students. In 2009, the Durham couple created the Tomorrow Fund at Triangle Community Foundation. The fund has raised nearly $470,000 and awards 28 to 30 scholarships a year to low-income Hispanic students who live in North Carolina. Graduated from a North Carolina high school, are the first generation in their family to continue their education beyond high school, attend a public or private college, university, or community college in the state, and maintain a 2.5 grade point average. The fund has made a difference, says Eva Lanivi, a former journalist who moved to the Triangle in 2003 with her husband, general manager of NetApp, a California-based data storage company. Consider Alberto Negrillas Aguilera, a Mexican native who, before age 11, moved to Wilkesboro with his father, a Baptist preacher and a cobbler, and his mother, a homemaker. After graduating from high school in 2008, Negrillas Aguilera could not afford to go to college and at the time was an undocumented resident of the U.S., so he went to work for a construction company. One summer, while installing a roof of shingles on a bank building in Boone, he saw a student from Appalachian Student State University, carrying a calculus textbook for a course he himself had completed in high school. It made me kind of choke back, he says. I thought of the potential I could have possibly if I'd gone to college, since I had already taken classes that students were just now taking while enrolled in college. Negrelos Aguilar applied to Appalachian State and was accepted, but was able to attend only with a scholarship from the Tomorrow Fund, which awards scholarships only if the schools also provide financial support. Now 24 and a junior majoring in chemistry, Negrelos Aguilar wants to get a doctorate in chemistry and a medical degree. Except for a three-year, $90,000 grant from Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, the Tomorrow Fund has raised nearly all its money from individuals, including from an event in January at the Chapel Hill Country Club that raised $35,000. Scholarships for Hispanic students can completely change the trajectory of their lives, economically, and their families' lives, says Eva Lenevi, and ultimately it can change our community. Also this week, on the philanthropy page of the Triangle Business Journal, a $1.33 million gift for North Carolina State University Engineering. The North Carolina State College of Engineering will receive a $1.33 million gift from Praxair Incorporated and its CEO, Stephen Angel, to support workforce development, diversity initiatives, and teaching and research related to the areas of engineering and technology of specific interest to Praxair. The gifts will support a mix of endowed and annual scholarships for students in chemical engineering and mechanical engineering to enhance diversity in the College of Engineering, as well as to pursue research and recruiting opportunities that will further the college's effort to train engineers in the fundamentals of sustainability. Also at Duke, there's a Jewish Life at Duke gets $1.9 million donation. Duke University trustee David N. Rubenstein is giving $1.9 million to Jewish Life at Duke to expand programming, fund building renovations, and to enhance the college experience for Jewish students. Most of the gift, $1.5 million, will fund new initiatives and staff positions for a Jewish student population whose needs and interests are changing, says Rebecca Simmons, the center's director. New programs are expected to reflect an increasing student demand for information and resources related to globalization, leadership, and community, she says. This week's executive voice is Donald Ginzig. Mr. Ginzig is a retired Rear Admiral and is the interim CEO at WakeMed Health and Hospitals. By any measure, Donald Ginzig didn't come to WakeMed Health and Hospitals under the best of circumstances. The hospital had just posted its first operating loss in years, wasn't projecting a better 2014, and had parted ways with former CEO Bill Atkinson. But don't ask Ginzig about the past, because he has his eyes set firmly on the horizon and what he needs to do to help take the hospital system forward. On October 24th, WakeMed announced Rear Admiral Ginzig as interim president and CEO. Ginzig was a commanding officer and reservist in the U.S. Navy who retired on October 1st from his active duty position as Rear Admiral, senior healthcare executive, and acting deputy surgeon general. He's tasked with keeping the WakeMed ship steady while a search committee interviews candidates to find the person who will take over full-time. WakeMed has 884 licensed hospital beds, including 98 designated for rehabilitation services. For its first fiscal quarter, which runs October through December, the hospital system had 10,230 discharges and ran an average daily occupancy of about 80%. Financially speaking, WakeMed posted an operating income of $252,000, or about a 0.3% operating margin. Other income, particularly from investments, helped buoy the system, however, and it posted an total income of nearly $10 million, a 10% margin. This is Triangle Business Journal's Q&A with Admiral Ginzig, and TBJ question is, what are your first impressions of WakeMed? Mr. Ginzig, that everyone here has a commitment to the mission of treating everyone. Having spent time in the military, I know something about mission, and the commitment to that mission is as strong here as any place I've been. And that's saying something. The attitude around here really is that this hospital is from the community, by the community, and for the community. TBJ, what's been your biggest challenge so far? Mr. Ginzig, figuring out the best model and structure to create partnerships with our physicians and community leaders, then in general leading an effort to move away from healthcare and towards health. We want to keep people healthy, not just treat their illnesses. TBJ, what are the biggest challenges facing the healthcare industry as a whole? Mr. Ginzig, increasing quality and decreasing cost and shifting to a culture in which we try to keep people healthy. Don't get me wrong, healthcare will always be in need. Being an organization that is in healthcare, if tomorrow everyone in the community was healthy, we would put up a sign and say mission accomplished and go do something else. But we know that's not going to happen. Still, we have to figure out how to move to a system of health, not just healthcare. TBJ, what are the strengths and weaknesses of the American healthcare system? Mr. Ginzig, there are some things we really do well. We are best in the world at cardiac care, at neurosurgery, and at trauma. But we haven't been the best in that health aspect. We haven't been the best at reducing the prevalence of disease, particularly like diabetes and obesity. That's a community effort that we want to help lead. TBJ, what's been your take of the triangle in general? Mr. Ginzig, the thing that I am most impressed with is I would match the friendliness of this region with any place I've been. This is one of the most deeply compassionate and friendly communities I've ever seen, and that's been from day one. TBJ, what's your favorite food at the hospital? Mr. Ginzig, don't tell the dietitian, but they make a really great fried chicken, and I only have it on special occasions. My home is just outside Nashville, and we have some great barbecue, but the food's pretty darn good in this area. TBJ, what's on your iPod? Mr. Ginzig, I have a diverse iPod. Exercise is AC/DC. Having lived in Nashville, I have some country. I'm anywhere from Motown to Jimmy Eat World, and my daughters, age 19, 21, and 22, help keep me young. I like asking them if they've heard the latest song. This week's Tweets of the Week on the Twitter activity. Thanks to all chancellors, college and university presidents and delegates and learned society members who joined us for installation today. And this Twitter comes from Deborah Sanders White, newly installed chancellor at North Carolina Central University. Also, Raleigh ranked number 10, the city's gaining the most college graduate, is tweeted by James Saul, Raleigh's economic development manager. And finally, this week's tweet, thank you, Autism Society of North Carolina, for inviting me to scoop ice cream on Free Cone Day at Ben & Jerry's in Chapel Hill. Ice cream is my favorite food. And that's from Woolly Bull, the official mascot of the Durham Bulls. I would say that this is the event of the week. Jim Bloom sure knows how to make an entrance. The CEO of Bayer Crop Science North America recently walked into the Senate building in Washington, D.C. carrying a live beehive. Bees are big news at Bayer Crop Science, which is opening its North American Bee Care Center this month in the Research Triangle Park. Other events that are happening. It looks like former U.S. Ambassador to Denmark, Jim Kane, is far from done with his worldly duties. As many of you remember, after his stately stint during President George W. Bush's second term, Raleigh resident Kane formed his own deal-making firm called Kane Global Partners. And just a couple of days ago, Triangle Business Journal was told the firm cut a deal with the iconic British luxury brand Fortnum & Mason to open the 300-year-old retailer's first store outside of London in Dubai. That may be interesting, but not quite as interesting as the people Kane hung out with during the opening of the store. Mr. Tom Parker Bowles, son of Camilla Bowles, wife of Prince Charles. Michael Corbin, U.S. Ambassador to the United Arab Emirates, and Fortnum CEO Ewan Venters. Triangle Business Journal caught up with Kane to get updated on his global roadmap, and he said, we have a few other brands to announce in the coming weeks in the Middle East and China, he says. It's no secret that Triangle Business Journal likes a hip song, including the popular song Happy by Pharrell Williams, the song that has inspired a number of viral videos, including one by Congressman John Lewis. Apparently, there is some science behind why Triangle Business Journal feels happy when listening to Happy. It's a cute song and is ready-made for all ages and demographics. How many other songs bother to do that with anymore, says Anthony Kelly, associate professor of the practice of music at Duke University Music Department. He says during the catchy chorus, it plays strategically on the harmonic contrast between notes that might exist in the diatonic minor and the modality mixed major modes, with it starting in the darkness of minor and ending on a big F major chord by the end of the word happy during the chorus. Well, that explains it. It's refreshing in that it does not have the vulgarity and hyper-sexualized lyrics that marked rap and popular music in recent media, Kelly adds. If you head to a Durham Bulls game this year, be sure to take a close look at Vince Belknome's legs, or more precisely, his tights. Belknome, who made the All-Star team in 2013, wears camouflage tights, though to him it's nothing really special. I always wear tights, and I like hunting, so I figured why not wear camo tights, he says. Makes sense to the Triangle Business Journal, especially when he's out there on a field of grass. Speaking of sports, North Carolina State Athletics Director Debbie Yao gives credit where credit is due. She has displayed her wit and dry sense of humor when accepting praise for the job the university did in hosting a portion of the NCAA basketball tournament this year. The Centennial Authority, which acts as the landlord of the PNC Arena, where a few rounds of the tournament were played, congratulated Yao for the work the athletics department did in what authority members said was a successful weekend. Replied Yao in her signature deadpan way, "Thank you, and we will extend it to those who actually did the work." There's a new sushi restaurant for Diamond View 3. Echelon Hospitality already has four restaurants operating under four different concepts in Raleigh. Now owner G. Patel is planning his first in Durham. Sources say Patel has signed a deal to open a new sushi restaurant called Basan that will be in the new Diamond View 3 office building in downtown Durham, joining the Q Barbecue restaurant, which and Moe's Southwest Grill on the ground floor of the building. Events in the past that make for the future. Mentoring Monday. The Triangle Business Journal's Women in Business Mentoring Monday event joined 43 mentors with more than 100 mentees at the Marriott City Center on April 4th. The event offered lessons in networking for women starting their own business or working in male-dominated fields like engineering, science, and technology. Also, a side of hickory-smoked beef brisket lies on the cutting board at City Barbecue in Cary, ready to be sliced by Trevor Simmons and Scott Harvey, pitmaster of the Cary location. Their business continues. And on April 5th, there were many crowds that were gathered along Person Street in Raleigh during the 9th Annual World Beer Festival. This was held at Moore Square. The festival delved into the art of beer experience with ingredient samplings, food and beer pairings, beer crafting seminars, and more. Beer lovers had a chance to enjoy food from local food trucks, live music, and the company of the local craft beer community. Continuing this stream of beer subjects, where is the beer? Well, I'm here to tell you that the Triangle-based breweries in Raleigh are Lone Rider Brewing Company, Crank Arm Brewing Company, Boylan Bridge Brewing Company. Coming soon is Nickel Point Brewing Company and Storm Clouds Brewing Company. Still here in the Triangle, there is Trophy Brewing Company, Natty Green's Pub and Brewing Company, Raleigh Brewing Company, Gizmo Brew Works, Triangle Brewing Company, Noose River Brewing Company. Coming soon, also coming soon, is Compass Rose. Sub Noir Brewing Company is here, Linwood Grill and Brewing Concern, and Big Boss Brewing Company, all are in Raleigh. In Durham, there's Full Steam Brewing Company, Bull City Burger and Brewery, and Ponysaurus Brewing Company. At Chapel Hill, you'll find Top of the Hill Restaurant and Brewery and the Carolina Brewery. In Cary, there's Fortnight Brewing Company. Apex is Brewprint Brewing Company, which is coming soon. Next to that, Holly Springs is Bombshell Beer Company and Carolina Brewing Company. In Hillsboro, you'll find Mystery Brewing Company. Carrboro has Steel String Brewing and Starpoint Brewing Company. In Fuquay Arena, you'll find Aviator Brewing Company and Draftline Brewing Company, coming soon. Down the road at Anger is the White Rabbit Brewing Company, and in Wake Forest is the White Street Brewing Company, and that is soon moving to Youngsville. This week's guest column is Mr. Greg Ganji. Mr. Ganji is the Associate Director for Education with the UNC Institute for Environment in Chapel Hill. His column is entitled, Clean Tech Collaborations Revving Up. As environmental news continues to grab headlines, business executives, state legislatures, economic developers, policy experts, and university researchers gathered for a first-ever regional clean tech summit in late February for a day-long discussion about North Carolina's clean tech industry. We came together to celebrate what happens in the industry and across our state in recent years, but also to talk about ways to design the future so that North Carolina maintains its leadership position as home to clean tech innovation, manufacturing, and deployment. UNC Chapel Hill's Institute for the Environment and UNC Chapel Hill's Keenan Flagler Center for Sustainable Enterprise organized the summit to build upon the connections between clean tech industry leaders and UNC Chapel Hill. The Research Triangle Clean Tech Cluster and Strata Solar partnered in the conference to ensure that it was a true collaboration between industry and academia. As an emerging industry representing trillions of dollars in investment, clean tech makes up the technologies involved in deploying solar power, energy efficiency, biofuels, alternative transportation, electric grid modernization, and more. Clean technologies represent a new way of tackling environmental challenges, a shift from the regulatory models to a market-driven approach that has been spurred by the recognition that price spikes, resource shortages, and security threats are real and persistent threats to the global economy. Clean tech broadly refers to the more efficient use of natural resources in products, services, and now processes, what some are now calling resource innovation. Even as definitions evolve, the Research Triangle region has had a 60-year head start in this sector. In 1954, Westinghouse Electric Corporation moved its electricity metering division to Raleigh from Newark, New Jersey. Other big names later arrived here: Cisco, Siemens, ABB, Sensus, and Schneider Electric. Some, like SAS, were created here. Today, these and other companies form a one-of-a-kind convergence of hardware, software, networking, and analytics that underpin clean technology's market-shaping solutions. These companies and others have recently come together to launch the Research Triangle Clean Tech Cluster to galvanize and capitalize on our regional competitive advantage. Speaking to the point of this sector's transformative potential at a lunchtime keynote, Lou D'Ambrosio, chairman of metering giant Sensus, said, "It's a changing world in the industry, and if we all don't transform, reinvent, and refocus, we're going to leave behind a world that's struggling with even bigger energy and environmental issues." The research and technology development underway at our universities is being shared and utilized by clean tech startups as well as by multinational corporations. For example, Strata Solar, a national leader in solar development based in Chapel Hill, credits the universities in the Research Triangle region as a key factor in the company's rapid growth over the last several years. UNC Chapel Hill faculty and researchers are currently involved in a wide range of clean tech projects, from advancing lithium-ion batteries to converting the sun's energy into hydrogen fuels and increasing the efficient use of water. Dozens of others of research projects underway at UNC as well as Duke University and NC State University are also supporting the growth of this industry. Indeed, the ongoing partnership between the region's academic institutions and the local firms specializing in clean tech, with policy leaders supporting and enabling discovery and commercialization, is the type of collaboration that has been at the heart of the Research Triangle's economic success for more than half a century. As the Clean Tech Summit illustrated, collaboration is made possible through the vision of business leaders, the support of policymakers, and the research capabilities of our universities. Let's keep working to grow this industry together. This week's column, The Editor's Notebook, by Mugeto Sergeyji, is entitled Shine More Light on Private Equity Firms. Mr. Mukherjee is the editor of the Triangle Business Journal. He writes, An internal review of private equity firms by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission offers a sobering lesson for all entrepreneurs and CEOs running companies in the Triangle. This is what the SEC determined. A majority of private equity firms are inflating fees and expenses and are charging them back to companies in which they hold stakes. Bloomberg News first reported the review findings. Think about it for a second. These private equity firms may own a large piece of your company, but they are taking out money from your company without the knowledge of you or of your other investors. About half of the 400 private equity firms did just that, the SEC says. Not only is this wrong, this could be the sole reason for the federal regulators to come in and set some sort of oversight parameters for the $3.5 trillion industry, which until now has gone largely unregulated. For businesses relying on capital from angel investors, venture capital firms, and private equity players, the management-investor relationship is cloaked in trust, with all partners working towards a common goal. Anything short of that, and you are going to have problems with management, employees, research, and direction. For the Triangle, this SEC finding is a huge issue, especially if we are looking for our entrepreneurs to grow and the community to prosper. In 2010, the Dodd-Frank law required most medium and large private equity players to register with the SEC. But somehow, because of the complex ownership and asset structure of many of these private equity funds, we know nothing more about how these private equity players operate than before the Dodd-Frank law took effect. And why is that good for the country, its entrepreneurs, its government pension fund managers, and most importantly, the workers who work in those portfolio companies? Remember Bernie Madoff? For its part, the SEC now wants more resources dedicated to inspect these complex funds, and Congress should give it these additional resources. We must put a stop to these secret transactions of fees, expenses, and dark deals to avoid the real asset value of properties. We talk about transparency every time a major calamity happens, and yet it seems like we never learn. Private equity plays a big role in the Triangle's economy, but the fund, its managers, and its asset structures must be regulated, as required by law. Let's get it done before we have another Madoff-like disaster. This week's column of Family Business by James Lee is entitled, How to Evaluate the Best Succession Strategy. Studies in the sociology of family business succession confirm that the greatest credit for a successful transfer of ownership and management to the next generation belongs to the senior owner. Likewise, when a succession effort goes down the old pipe, the senior owner is usually at the center of the problem. Here are some questions to consider in analyzing your family's company's senior leadership. Is the senior owner the founder or a successor? This is important because a founder has probably committed a lifetime to putting the business together and growing it, developing an identification with the business that makes giving it up very difficult. In addition, the classic entrepreneur, which many business founders are, seldom trusts the business skills of others like he trusts his own. A successor senior owner can also have problems handing it over to the next generation. If he had to struggle to prove himself to his parents, he may make the same demands of his own children. On the other hand, successor owners are more likely to look outside their immediate family for capable successors and evaluate them more objectively. A lot of technology industry startups in the last 20 years have been built directly on their founders' technical expertise and creativity. There are many companies whose character and daily operations are totally controlled by the preferences of the CEO. In those cases, the next generation of family leadership will either have to reflect the style, expertise, and personality of the retiring owners, or will have to fight for the right to do things differently. Even in a society where clan identity isn't very strong, many families acknowledge one or more senior members as family leaders. They tend to set the standards for conduct and philosophy, and they're consulted on most important family matters. A successful family business chief executive must have the family support and encouragement, as well as enough ownership control to operate the company as he or she sees fit. A rising family executive can't count on that family support if every management decision is second-guessed by the retired CEO, who's still viewed as the family's chief opinion maker. Is the senior owner really committed to succession and ready to hand over control? If not, the only way to get new family leadership in place is when old leadership is hauled away in a box. None of these factors guarantee the success or failure of a family business succession, but they are important enough that every one of them should be considered in the analysis that's part of good succession planning. As we leave March, which proved to be a good time for biotech companies to hit the public markets, especially when compared to last year, the figures provided compared for the first quarter of this year to the first quarter of 2013. They are as follows. Global initial public offerings. In 2013, there were 7. In 2014, to date, there are 41. Money raised in 2013 was $2.9 billion. It was $3 billion year to date for 2014. And privately held biotechs raised more money, as well as noted in the information, illustrating money raised in the first quarter by private biotech companies. In 2013, that was $2.6 billion. Year-to-date is $3.3 billion in 2014. And life sciences, mergers and acquisition deals shot up to 190%. 2013, that was $16.4 billion, and 2014 was $47.5 billion year-to-date. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at triangleradioreadingservice.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next